So I think we're skipping in between Perek Tetzvot and Perek Tzion. We're looking at different psukim. So I want to go backwards a little bit. Just some verses in Perek Tetzvot, chapter 15. Again, just to remind you, I think the last pasuk we looked at was pasuk Yud Tes. This is 15:19. And you remember the interesting interpretation of the Gra? The Gra said, right, the way of a lazy person is like a road that is filled with thorns, and the way of the upright is clear. So there are two pshatim that one can give here. One is, this is a similar idea to what Shlomo HaMelech expresses later, which we actually learned that a long time ago, in which when a person is lazy, everything looks very hard. He looks at life and all he sees are obstacles. It's so hard to get up, it's so hard to learn, it's so hard. It's as if everywhere he goes is filled with thorns. And that is because if a person does not see the ultimate value of what he's doing, then any little effort seems like it's tremendous. Like, why should I waste my energy on something that's just not significant? So to the lazy person, so again, later on Shlomo used a more vivid metaphor. He actually said, to a lazy person it's like a lion in the road. Here it says it's like thorns in the road. But to the righteous person, even if there are obstacles, lehebuch, he doesn't even see the obstacles that much because he just goes through what he needs to go through. Now the Gra learned a little differently. The Gra here, because again, and actually it makes sense, because if the idea simply is that laziness makes us perceive difficulties which aren't really there, then, you know, you're back to the problem. Why say the same thing twice? Although the Maaseh Mishlei is a big problem because many, many psukim seem to say the same thing twice. So the Gra learns, just a quick chazara, the Gra learns that Shlomo HaMelech is merames to the famous mashal that Chazal give, that sometimes we look for shortcuts that turn out to be very long. Remember, there's a famous medrash where a person is wandering around Yerushalayim and he asks a kid, how do I get, what's the shortest way to get to this destination? So the child said, do you want the short way that's long or the long way that's short? And the person didn't understand. He said, just tell me the short way, shortest way. So the person gave him the shortest way, and it turned out that way was the shortest as the crow flies, but it was filled with thorns and rocks, and it took much longer. The other way, he'd have to walk around, but he'd get there. So the person, like, you know, cut his legs, and it took him, you know, took him hours to get through this short way. And he asked the kid, I thought you told me the short way. He said, yeah, I told you the short way that's long. I could have given you the long way that's short. That would have been, you know, walking. So the Gra says that's exactly what this pasuk means. And that is, the lazy person is looking for shortcuts. But in the long term, those shortcuts are going to take much, much more time than had he made the investment. This happens in learning all the time. Let's say a person has a goal. Let's say the goal, you want to be able to learn Gemara yourself. So instead of, you know, working with the Jastra, or instead of making worksheets, you simply take out the art scroll every time. Now again, I have absolutely nothing against art scroll, and I am, you know, there are times, don't tell anybody, I will even use it myself, you know. So there's nothing against it. It's a wonderful, wonderful safer. But the thing is, it's a wonderful thing that, you know, when you know how to learn Gemara, then you can use it to supplement, to add things. But if you're trying to acquire a skill, so these shortcuts are going to actually make it much, much, much longer. So it seems that, oh, Baruch Hashem, I get an instant pshat right here. But the pshat is, it's going to take much, much longer, if ever, that you'll be able to translate something yourself, right? So the guy who's looking for a parking spot near a store, Okay? So he drives around 2 hours waiting for the spot to clear instead of parking, you know, 6 blocks away where he'd walk in and be there within 10 minutes. Because so according to the Gra, that is what the Pasuk is Maram is. It's not referring to the imaginary obstacles that the Otzel has, but it's referring to the real obstacles he's going to encounter because he looked for shortcuts. And when you look for shortcuts, ultimately it's going to be counterproductive, right? And we find this all, Havdil, it's true in business even. People try to cut corners by not doing a certain thing, so then they get into all sorts of problems later on, and those problems are much, much worse. They could have been averted by a little bit of work in the beginning. So the Gra says that's why a person has to realize that the meaningful accomplishments in life and the meaningful levels of ruchnius require investment. They require a certain work. They require yegiya, but that yegiya will actually be sulala. Sulala, to be mesalel, means to remove stones from the road. In other words, the otzel is going on a road in which he's going to encounter blockages because of his shortcuts. But the yashoy, the one who is committed to the right thing, will find eventually that although he's taking a longer road, right, exactly what the kid said, you know, the long road that is short, taking the longer road, it's going to be shorter, it'll get him to his destination. Because after all, no matter how long a long road is, it will be shorter than the one that doesn't get you there. The one that doesn't get you there is a road that goes on forever, because it doesn't get you there. So by definition, no matter how long it takes, any road that will get me to where I need to go is a better road. That's what reminds me of the Chafetz Chaim about roads, where somebody once visited the Chafetz Chaim, and Chafetz Chaim lived basically in a dirt floor. He didn't have, which was uncommon even for Gedolim. That was very uncommon. I mean, most Gedolim had floors and curtains, but the Chafetz Chaim lived in a dirt floor. No curtains, no nothing. The furniture were just some broken tables and chairs. So the person was very, very embarrassed. He said to the Chafetz Chaim, he says, Rebbe, you know, where's all the furniture? So the Chafetz Chaim said to him, where's your furniture? He says, I'm just traveling. I don't take my furniture with me. So the Chafetz Chaim says, me too. I'm just traveling. This is not where I live. I live in, my ultimate destination is Olam Haba. I'm just traveling through. I don't have to have all my furniture with me when I'm traveling through Olam Haba. Okay. Yeah. All right, so now I wanted to show you another pasuk. Again, go back a little bit. You'll see why. It's not that I have a lot to say in this pasuk, and the Gra does not say a lot in this pasuk, but it's a famous pasuk, so it's kedai to look at. This is going backwards a little bit to pasuk Tesvav, verse 15. The pasuk says, "Kol yemei ani ra'im." All the days of a poor person are bad, are difficult. V'tov leiv, but a person that has a good heart, mishte tamid. Mishte is life is a perpetual party. So first of all, again, we have two pshatim. The Gemara takes the first statement very literally. A poor person is always suffering. You know, life is hard. So the Gemara asks the Kasha, he's always suffering? What about Shabbos and Yom Tov when he has a good meal? So the Gemara says, very practical. Even then he suffers because a change of diet will upset his digestion. Meaning to say, yeah, even when he gets a good meal, he doesn't enjoy it because it's going to upset his stomach. He's not used to it. Actually, that's not so much of a joke. I mean, there actually were people, they were Yidden, who died after the liberation of the concentration camps. But when the U.S. came in, or even the Russians came in, and gave them, and I'm talking about kosher food, I'm not talking about people who ate in trade, you know, gave them, you know, food, they ate, you know, meat and chocolates. Some of them dropped dead. Their systems could not take it because there had been years and years and years of really fasting, basically a total deprivation. The Gemara, now to go back to the Gemara itself, if you remember, there was a great, great tzaddik at the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni, Rav Tzaddok. And one of the things that Rav Gamliel requested from the emperor, I'm sorry, Rav Chaim Ben Zakkai requested from the emperor, they should spare Rav Gamliel and spare Yavne, where the Chachamim could go after the destruction, and get us a doctor or medical treatment for Rav Tzaddok. Rav Tzadok had fasted for 40 years. Now, he ate a little bit at night, obviously. You can't fast. But he had fasted for 40 years to avert the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara says, had there been one other tzaddik, had there been two tzaddikim like Rav Tzadok, Hashem could not have destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That would have been enough of a zechus. Nebuch, there was only one Rav Tzadok, so that wasn't enough. Yeah.
Food is a good thing, but in that case, it was too much food was a bad thing.
That's right.
I'm assuming the same thing of kedusha. A little bit kedusha is a good thing, but too much at the same time could destroy a person. When Mashiach comes, I'm guessing if we get the true revelation all at the same time, we would be destroyed. We should come to us like in stages, so we could gradually be ready for.
Well, in the abstract, kedusha is only good, but there is a concept that kedusha is described as light, and we who receive kedusha are described as vessels. And when our vessel is not strong enough to contain the light, we smash and we're crushed. Yeah, so it is very true that kedusha, which comes to you when you're not on a madrega to receive it, becomes very, very destructive. It can destroy you simply because you're not able, you're not on the madrega to be makabel. That is what happened to Nadav and Avihu. When they dedicate the Mishkan, they bring a fire in and the Shekhinah comes out. In fact, that generally, the Nitziv says that's even Makas Bechoros. The way Hashem killed the firstborn of Egypt was simply by appearing to them. So it's not that Hashem killed them, just the revelation of Hashem, right? What does Hashem say to Moshe? Man cannot see me, meaning perceive me and live, meaning it's the perception of the Shekhinah itself on the deepest level that can kill a person, because the soul can no longer stay in the body.
Yeah, Moshe said that if a person comes to Mount Sinai, he would also die. The fence of the Mount Sinai,
he should
be fenced so nobody would touch it. Is that also the same concept? If a person would touch it, he would have too much kedusha and that would kill him?
Right, you have to be worthy for kedusha. Again, the whole... In Kabbalah, one of the central ideas is called Shvira Sakelim. Shvira Sakelim means the breaking of the vessels, that light comes into a vessel, although it's a metaphor that doesn't really fit necessarily. We normally don't look at light as, although the lasers and light, we don't look at light as breaking something, but the idea that the light is so powerful that it disintegrates and fractures. In fact, the whole Kabbalistic idea is that even evil represents sparks of holiness, as if everything exploded and there are sparks of holiness that are trapped in evil places. That's why Rus from the nation of Moab, which is an evil nation, was a spark of holiness that had to be liberated, had to be brought back to Kedusha.
Rabbi Akiva also? He was from Amalek?
Not Rabbi Akiva, but it mentions that...
His father was also from Rome. Convert from Rome.
Rabbi Kiva is descended from converts, yeah. But the Gemara mentions, I don't think Rabbi Kiva comes from Amalek, but it does mention that there were grandchildren of Haman, or great descendants of Haman, who were teachers of Torah in Bnei Brak. Now, maybe you're saying Rabbi Kiva, it's interesting, because Rabbi Kiva's city was Bnei Brak. So it's interesting, but I don't recall a direct statement. Maybe it's interesting. Maybe they wanted to cover it up. It's interesting why it doesn't say. If it would have been Rabbi Akiva, one would have expected they would have said it. Instead, they say the descendants. Now, that's a whole halachic question. Aren't you supposed to kill Amalek? But the short answer is, the Megillas Esther says Haman was killed and the 10 sons of Haman were killed. But it's mashma that there were children of those 10 sons who survived. And why wasn't there a mitzvah to kill them? Right, that's a whole interesting question. Moshe Sternbach writes that there is no mitzvah to kill an individual Amalekite. The mitzvah is only if you could eradicate the whole nation. And when you don't have the ability to eradicate the whole nation, in other words, if I were to meet an Amalekite today, I would, even if I could get away with it and I knew he was an Amalekite, I would not be obligated to kill him, because I wouldn't be eradicating the nation, meaning that it's not a mitzvah to kill individual Amalekites. It's a mitzvah to participate in the eradication of this nation. And if that would not be possible, for whatever reason, there is no chiyuv. That's what Rav Moshe Sternbach writes. But that's why you find that there were Amalekites in David HaMelech's time. I mean, that's why Haman was able to be there. Now, the Gra learns another pshat, though. So according to the Gemara, he was basically saying, kind of a practical lesson, that even that someone who's habituated... Oh yeah, I'm sorry, I want to go back to Rav Tzedek. So the thing with Rav Tzedek is that Rav Tzedek was so emaciated that all he could eat initially would be, he would suck the juice out of a fig and let the juice go down his throat. And the Gemara says, perhaps it's hyperbole, perhaps it's guzma, that you could actually see, as he was translucent, you could see the juice go down his throat like an x-ray. And it took a very long time till he gradually, after the Churban already, it was no use fasting, so he was gradually brought back to health. So indeed, the Gemara's point, that for the Ani, the change of diet can be very, very injurious, is absolutely the case. But the Gra learns a different pshat, again, a very beautiful pshat. The Gra learns that the definition of an Ani is the opposite of an Ashir, right? Ani is poor, Ashir is rich. Now, Chazal gave us a definition of who's an Ashir. Eizeyu Ashir hasomeach b'chelto, one who is happy in whatever life gives him, whatever Hashem gives him, he's happy. So, it's not too rachuk to say, if Chazal define an Ashir as Sameach b'chelko, then we can call an Ani as a person that's not Sameach b'chelko. Although Chazal don't say that beferish, but it's obvious. If rich means Sameach b'chelko, then we can say, who is poor? No matter how rich you are poor if you don't find joy and satisfaction in what Hashem gives you. So, that's exactly what the Pasuk says. It's all about attitude. If a person's an Ani, he always sees the negative. He always complains. He always feels whatever he has isn't good enough. Every single day is going to be miserable because he's never going to reach the level of rejoicing in what he has. And indeed, this fits the Pasuk beautifully because this is exactly what the Pasuk is saying. If your attitude in life is ani, you don't rejoice, then all of your life will be miserable, as opposed to tov lev. Tov lev is the opposite idea. Tov lev is the person, he has a good heart, meaning he's grateful for everything Hashem gives him. Life can be a perpetual party. Meaning to say, you know, if Nachum of Breslov talks about, he gives a mashal about a poor man who had nothing. And he walks out and he looks at the grass, he looks at the miles of the city, he says, this is all mine, I can walk anywhere. I can look at anything, you know, he says, this is all mine, the parks are mine, the trees are mine, the fruits are mine, he said that, says, what's the difference, would it make a difference if I own it, what's the difference if I own a million acres, I just can walk through it and enjoy it. And this idea that, you know, it sounds like a frivolous statement, but this is Shlomo HaMelech's statement, Tov Lev, a person with an attitude of gratitude and joy for what God has given him, Mishtat Tamid, life is a party. Now certainly, neither the Gra nor Shlomo HaMelech would be advocating, you know, partying 24/7. We don't mean a party in terms of, you know, drinking or dancing around. But it's a certain attitude of joy. That one can have joy in life. That even when life is difficult, one can appreciate the beauty of life, the opportunities of life. The idea that even in Gashmias, Rabbi Victor Miller, I mentioned before, has a whole meditation on an apple. When you look at an apple and you think about the colors and the textures and the acidity and the different tastes. It's taken from the Chayv HaSolovavus in the Shara Bechina that says Hashem gives us color and Hashem gives us music. These are not things that are necessary for survival. If the only thing was to be stayed alive, Hashem could have given us you know, glop that we could eat or whatever. But he bedavka created things that give us pleasure and joy. And one can look at that. One can look at the water as a wonderful thing. So the Gra says that's exactly what the Pasuk is saying. You can be a millionaire. A millionaire doesn't carry you very far today. Yeah, we have to be a billionaire. You can be a billionaire, but your life can be miserable. Because you're not a sameach b'chelko, okay? But if you're tov lev, mishtat tamid. And you know, you find quite a lot that gedolim will often say it. I mean, not so much the European gedolim; they don't talk that way. But gedolim that are talking to American audiences, they will often say, I want you to know how wonderful my life was. They talk about in those terms, that life was wonderful. You know, you may think it was hard, you may think it was difficult. It was wonderful. And they're not just talking, see, they're not just talking in the ruchniyistic sense. They're saying that emotionally, they felt that life was a joyous, happy experience. That's tov lev mishtatamit. Yeah.
Are you saying that in America people say that the life is enjoyable, in Europe they say that not so?
No, I don't mean to say that. I just mean to say that the European mindset is a little different. In other words, the European didn't think, gee, am I happy or am I not? You know, they didn't think in those particular terms.
Is this a bash in Europeans?
Oh, no, it's a bash in Americans, if anything. Europeans had a stronger sense of duty. You know, life was about duty, you know, you don't think about, am I happy? But Lamaisa, the grudge sneaks it in. The grudge does sneak it in. I mean, people say, for example, well, Litvaks are never happy anyway, right? I mean, Litvaks, Lithuanian, you know, the yeshiva world, we can say, although most of us are not from Lithuanian descent. I myself am not. But for some reason, in Eretz Yisrael, we call the non-Hasidic yeshiva world, we call them Litaim, Litvaks, Lithuanians. Why are Lithuanians? I don't know if anyone... The only reason is because the greatest yeshivos, Volozhin, Slobodka, Mir, Kamenets, to which we try to be an heir, happen to have been in Lithuania. So everyone that's connected to that yeshiva world are called Lithuanians in Israel, even though, you know, you're not Lithuanian. So the Haredi world is divided between Lithuanians, which, let's say, are us, Hasidim, and the third group is Brisk. Now, Brisk is obviously Lithuanian, but Brisk is a third group, whatever it is.
The same as Mislakim?
Huh? Lithuanians and Brisk are Misnagdim and Hasidim. And then, of course, you have Svardim, too. There are Svardim Haredim as well. Right. And within Svardim, there's Moroccan, too. You know. So there are many, many other subgroups. But among Ashkenazim, the big groups are Lithuanian, Hasidim and Brisk. Brisk, for some reason, wants to be the third thing. So people say, oh, Hasidim are happy, you know, they rejoice, they dance, they sing. But Litvaks are very, very somber, serious. They learn all the time, But the emphasis is, you see from the writing of the Gra. The Gra, of course, is the Litvak par excellence. And Vilna is the Litvisha city par excellence, right? Vilna. Vilna is the capital of Lithuania. But you see that they do write about Simcha. But Simcha is a different form. Simcha is not necessarily for a Litvak. But everyone is different. I'm not saying it has to be this way. But for a Litvak, Simcha didn't have to be something that, you know, you're laughing and singing and dancing on the table. It's kind of an inner. A certain inner Simcha. Inner Simcha. Like when Rabbi Yashuv, for example, was not a person who demonstrably, you know, was always laughing and the like. But, you know, when he would learn by himself, there would be a niggun, he would be singing. There was, in fact, they caught him. They actually have a video of Rebbe Yashuv, like 45 minutes. Oh, my, I don't know how they get rishus for this and how they're allowed to even do this, but they took a picture of him sitting and learning. Just, you know, and you could see, by the way, what an Amel B'Torah he is. I mean, he must have gone through, you know, how many times did he go through Shas? You know, it's way, way beyond what we could count. And yet, he was really like, thinking and working. He was like working on Pshat, and he wasn't like looking up a lot of stuff. He just had the Gemara in front of him, and, you know, he was hitting his head, and, you know, different things. Imamish Yegia, Yegia B'Torah Mamish, closing his eyes, you know, tight, you know, thinking. But you see that, but not for everything, meaning other times he would be just covering ground, meaning when he hit a hard point, you know. And when he was covering ground, he had a beautiful, sweet niggun that he would be singing to himself. You could see the inner happiness. So simcha is tov lev mishta tamit. Tov lev mishta tamit. But simcha doesn't have to be the Karl Bach minion or those types of things. Again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that either, but simcha can take different forms. Litvaks also has simcha, you know, but it may not be the same form as Hasidim. Now, what's interesting is that this very phrase, tov lev mishta tamit, Yeah, the last words of the Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, right? The Aruch Chaim is the first chelik of the Shulchan Aruch. And does anyone know, do you remember, what halachos are the end of Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim? What holiday is the end of Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim? Hilchos Purim. Hilchos Purim is the end of the Mishnah Berurah. That's Aruch Chaim. And after the Shulchan Aruch goes through the laws of drinking on Purim and the like, the Ramah adds a Haggah that, on Purim there's a special mitzvah to drink, but Tov Lev Mishta Tamid, but one that has a happy heart, for him he's drinking the whole year, meaning it's a party the whole year. That's how the Shulchan Aruch ends. With at least the first Aruch Chaim, Tov Lev Mishta Tamid. And it's interesting that how does the Shulchan Aruch begin? It also begins with a sentence that has the word Tamid in it. Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. That's David HaMelech's verse. I place Hashem before myself at all times. I always think, I imagine, although it's not imagine, it's a reality, that Hashem is in front of me. So some Svarim want to say we make kind of a Gezeira Shava, Tamid Tamid. When will a Tov Lev have a perpetual joy? When will you have a Mishteh Tamid? If it's Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, when you have a presence of Hashem, when you have an awareness of the presence of Hashem. But when you try to have joy without a Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, it's not going to be joyous. It's ultimately going to be destructive. So Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid has to be balanced with Tov Lev, which Tov Lev Mishteh Tamid. Both of them come together. In fact, Rav Matisyahu Salman, Mashgiach of Lakewood, said a very interesting expression. You know, we talk about in Kriya Shema, right? Mitzvah Deraisa of Kriya Shema. Every single day we have to say the Shema in the morning and in the evening. So what do we call the mitzvah of Kriya Shema? Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim. The acceptance of the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, that I accept Hashem as my master. Now, almost everybody, in fact, probably everybody until he said this, this is his chiddush, we think of an ol as a burden, something that's put on you. You assume the burden of being subservient to Hashem as an Eved Hashem. But he makes the point that a yoke actually makes the work easier for an animal, meaning to say like this, if I were to simply tie an animal to a plow and it wouldn't have a yoke, that framework, then all of the weight would be pulling at the animal's neck or whatever it is, and it would be very, very painful and difficult, maybe impossible. The yoke, it's a whole frame, that redistributes the weight of the wagon and it makes it easier to pull. So, therefore, Rav Matisyahu Salman suggests that the word ol has two connotations side by side. On one hand, it means we are like the beasts of burden that must carry out Hashem's will. Yes. But Hashem gives it to us through an ol that makes it easier for us and joyous for us, as opposed to something that's physically and emotionally demanding. And therefore, the idea of ol, side by side with the notion of subservience to the Ribono Shel Olam, also connotes that Hashem makes it easier for us at the same time. And that's also the idea of Tov Lev Mishteh Tamid when you have Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. Okay. Look at the next Pasuk Tesayin. Of Tov Ma'at B'yiras Hashem Me'otzer Rav Mahum Abba. Right? These are all short aphorisms. It is better to have a little in life accompanied with Yiras Hashem, with fear of God, rather than a great, great treasure with mahuma, with a lot of tumult. So again, the simple meaning is it refers to material wealth. That is, if a person gathers very little, but he has Yiras Hashem, his home and his life is going to be much more blessed than someone that has so much great wealth, but there's not Yiras Hashem. Because when there's not Yiras Hashem, then number one, there's stealing, dishonesty, fraud, lying, machlokes, sinas chinam. And once again, you're not going to be able to even enjoy your wealth. when there's Yiras Hashem, then everything is going to be in order. Now the Gra explains, though, that the wealth in Pasuk Tesayin is referring to Torah knowledge. And he says the following. It's an interesting point. He says that sometimes a person learns L'shem Shamayim. A person learns to serve Hashem. A person learns to because he reveres Hashem. And of course, Yiras Hashem has two meanings. There is Yiras Hashem because of punishment, right? What does it mean, fear of God? So fear of God has two meanings. The word fear in English is not really a good translation of yira. There is what is called yiras ha'onesh. Yiras ha'onesh means fear of punishment. I better behave, because if I don't, God may punish me. Maybe in this world, and if not in this world, the world to come. Right? So I'm going to behave because I'm afraid of the consequences. But there's another definition of yira, which is not fear, but it's reverence. It is awe. It is respect. That's also called yira. The word yira, see, the word fear in English doesn't encompass that. But in Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, yira can mean fear of punishment, but it can also mean awe, reverence, and deep respect. The Rishayim describe the first as yiras ha'onesh, fear of punishment. And they describe the second as yiras haromamus, reverence for God's greatness. We know that even in human relationships you have that. For example, if the President of the United States were to walk in, even if we personally don't particularly like what he does, now he's not going to kill you. These types of kings, you know, they can't kill you, but you still have a certain respect. You would be in awe. Perhaps the president of Israel as well, although Israelis are less formal. Netanyahu, you know, who knows? And the like. So that's kind of respect for the office. That's awe. That's reverence. The Queen of England, whatever it is. And Chazal even say, the Gemara in Brachos says that if a king with an entourage is passing through town, you should try to go to see them. You should try to get a sense of awe, reverence, honor, glory, because that will give you a little bit of sense of what Mashiach is like. That can make Mashiach a little bit more real to us. Okay, a little bit. And the Gemara says in Brachos. Now, if that involves Bittul Torah, one should ask a Shailas. You know, again, the Gemara does not go through the halachos of how you balance it against other things. That's a different question. But it does establish as a positive idea, li'aylam yorutz likras malchei umos ha'olam. Ad kidei kach, and this is another halachic matter, the Gemara says that there were amoran that were kohanim, that would jump over coffins that had dead bodies in them, to be able to see the kings. And Rashi and Tosas of Ahol Arichus, what's going on here? A Kohen, right? A Kohen who walks over a dead body. Tumah goes straight up. They're like an OL. They become like a tent over a dead body. They become Tamei. How could a Kohen become Tamei to see a non-Jewish king? And Rashi and Tosas have a whole Arichas that because the coffin has a Tefach, meaning the rule basically is that although if I walk over a dead body, I walk over a grave, I become Tamei, but if there's a space of a tefach from the body, you know, vacant, you know, airspace, that forms a roof that blocks the tumah from coming up. And therefore, a Kohen theoretically can walk over a grave if there's a tefach of airspace between the dead body and the top of the coffin. And it's only an Isser Drabanan. It is an Isser Drabanan. And Mimela, Rashi learns the sukkah, that to see a non-Jewish king, they were permitted to violate an Isser Drabanan. Still a tremendous chiddush. Okay, Tosfos has the kasha, it's an Isser Doraisa. Okay, that's a whole other issue. But the point there is, that's a matter of reverence. Now, so when it says Yiras Hashem, you have to study every single verse. Are we talking about Yiras HaOnesh or Yiras HaRomamus? The Gra seems to understand that it's referring to Yiras HaRomamus, and he learns this way. He says, if you learn Torah, and most of your Torah, you were doing it for ulterior motives, to get kavod, to get honor, to get glory, to show off. And a little bit of your Torah, once in a while, you reached a level where it was L'Shem Shamayim. After 120 years, you will get more reward. That's what he says, Tov. You will get more reward for the little bit of Torah that you learned with Yirat Shamayim than the abundance of Torah that you learned with ulterior motives. But that's how he learns it. Now, the Gra is not saying, and Badafka, he switches the pasuk to say, it's not saying that, let's say, in other words, like this. See, the Gra Badafka is very, it's very clever. The Gra doesn't need to be very clever, but he's very medayik in something here, because I could have read the pasuk, taking his commentary, I could have read the pasuk this way. It is better to learn a little bit with Yiras Shamayim than to learn a lot without Yiras Shamayim. I couldn't. Now, what that would have meant is the following. That would have meant, if I would have said it that way, that would have meant, let's say I'm capable of only learning 5 minutes a day with Yiras Shamayim, but I can learn 6 hours a day without Yiras Shamayim if I have these motivators. So you might have thought, learn 5 minutes instead of 6 hours. See, that might, the Gra Badafka doesn't learn that way. He says, this pasuk is not telling you not to learn without Yiras Shamayim. Just saying that b'sach hakol, in all of your learning, you're going to get more reward for the 5 minutes of Yiras Shamayim than for the 6 hours without Yiras Shamayim. But if you wouldn't have learned those 6 hours without Yiras Shamayim, you're going to get punished for Bittul Torah. So, by all means, don't use this as a basis for not learning those 6 hours. But b'sach hakol, the schar is going to be greater. For this one, the Gra Badafka seems to go out of his way, Badafka, so you shouldn't say, I have a choice, of learning 5 minutes or 6 hours. That you can't do. And then, of course, there's another idea too. Chazal themselves say that a person should always learn Torah and do mitzvos, even if it's not l'shem shemayim. Why? Shemitoch shelo l'shma. By learning Torah and doing mitzvos, not l'shem shemayim, but you're still purifying your soul, and that will eventually bring you lishma. So mitzvahs and Torah shelo lishma are certainly a mitzvah, and you certainly it improves you, it raises you, it elevates you. It's not on the highest level as Yiras Hashem, but it's still something that one pursues because it can bring a person to Yiras Hashem. Yeah.
There's a tekiyahu that says that a person should do the will of Hashem not because of their word, but because of the...
Right, exactly. That's the very beginning of Pirkei Avos. Right. Antignus is so...
It's a stira.
Well, it's not telling you not to do it. It says you should try to do it not for the sake of reward, meaning do not be... It's not telling you not to do it. It says do not be a servant who serves Hashem for the purpose of getting reward. Be a servant who serves Hashem for the purpose of not getting reward, because you just want to serve Hashem. Good, but that's not the same thing as telling you, therefore, if you're not there yet, don't do it. It's the goal. It's the goal to which you're going to. So, therefore, according to the Gra, Pasuk Tesayin is telling me the all-important idea of striving to learn Torah L'Shem Shemayim. There's a whole discussion that's interesting. The Chassam Sofer has a discussion about this. Originally, the Torah Shebal Peh, the part of the Torah that was Bal Peh, was not supposed to be written down. It was usher to write down. Right? That's why it was transmitted for hundreds of years, because we were not allowed to put it to writing. But Rav Yehuda HaNasi finally wrote down the main principles of the Torah Shebal Peh, because they were, as the generations were getting worse and worse, as the persecutions were getting greater and greater, there was a very real sakana that they would be forgotten. And if Chas v'Shalom had got forgotten, how do you reconstruct it? So even though it was an aveira to write down Torah Shebal Peh, the Mishnah was written down based on a teaching in Tehillim, Eis Laseis Lashem, when it is a time to stand up for God, Heferu Torasecha, we are allowed to violate the Torah. Now again, this is a very risky teaching, because this could be used by reform, that could be used by everybody. So only the greatest of the Chachamim can do this. But there are times in which it was recognized that you needed to violate this aspect of the Torah in order to keep the Torah alive. And that was a very, very unusual. And that is why, by the way, later the Gemara was written down, but that is why the Mishnah is written in such a very, very strange way. If you think about this, you have the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah was written around, or compiled around the year 200 of the Common Era. Again, just to give you, remember your dates here. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. And Klal Yisrael is under Roman domination in Eretz Yisrael. In the year 130, we had the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was mercilessly crushed at Beitar. And the number of Jews that died in the Bar Kokhba revolt at Beitar were worse than even the Chorban. And the Gezeris, in fact, Rabbi Kiva was killed, right? And all of those evil decrees of the Romans, that you weren't allowed to teach Torah, they were not in the aftermath of the Chorban, they were in the aftermath of Beitar. Beitar inaugurated the Gezeros against learning Torah, against Bris Milah, all of these in Yanim. The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Romans did mainly as a political reason. They wanted to crush Jewish sovereignty, but they were not against the Jewish religion per se. But after Beitar, no more Mr. Nice Guy, so to speak. They were much, much worse. So, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, right, we're talking about the half century or so after Beitar. So he understood that the persecutions were getting very, very difficult. But at his time, the Emperor Antoninus happened to be a good friend of Rebbe. That's why he wrote the Mishnah then, because there was a respite. Now, if you look at the Mishnah, again, I'm just going to tell you a general thing. So the Mishnah says a din, right? And the Gemara asks Akasha, how could this be? It contradicts something else. So the Gemara might say something like, okay, you're right. This Mishnah is referring only to a certain case. And the case might be a very unusual case, meaning the normal rule in 99% of the cases is this. The Mishnah says something else. The Mishnah is talking about some case. That's a crazy way to write something. You're writing a general rule that only applies to the 1 out of 1,000 cases, and you don't give us the rule that applies in 999 of the cases? Is that what you do? I mean, if you're writing a book of laws, you either give me both cases, or if you're only going to choose one, you give me the one that normally applies, not the one that abnormally applies. Or the Mishnah's din applies only if there's a certain condition. Or you got to put certain words in the Mishnah. What is that? If that's how you write a book, you would fail composition. But the answer is this. The answer is that since it was usher to write Tarish HaBaal Peh, it was usher. But it was only mutter because otherwise it would be forgotten. He only wrote just enough that it would trigger the memory of somebody who had learned it Baal Peh, so they would be able to reconstruct. You understand the idea? Because the concept was, it was a memory jogger. Like when you're making your own notes, you don't have to put every single detail. If you have some information, you're going to remember the missing pieces. And therefore the Mishnah is written like a jigsaw puzzle that is incomplete, but you can remember where some of the pieces go. That's goofa because Eis Lasei Slashem was not a total matter, at least in those days. It only allowed you to do enough for what was necessary. So the Chassam Sefer writes somewhere that since intrinsically it is usher to write down Torah Shebaal Peh, and it's only mutter because otherwise it would be forgotten, and it's Eis Lasei Slashem, that's only going to be mutter if your kavana is totally l'shem shamayim. Eis Lasei Slashem. I am doing it for Hashem. He says, if you are writing a sefer for kavod, you're writing a sefer for recognition. He says, it would be usher for you to write the sefer, because you're not doing it for Hashem. And therefore, even if you're Tyra Zemes, it would be a violation of writing down Torah Shebal Peh. And even if I say normally mitzvahs don't need kavanah, but this mitzvah needs kavanah, because it says Eis Lasai Shlashet, when it's time to do for Hashem. Right? This is a mitzvah, or whatever, it's a directive or a heker that is toloy on kavanah. It's a big chiddush. I don't know if we're not neglecting the chasam sefer. That would be a very difficult standard to say. You're only allowed to write a sefer if kavanah is l'shem shemayim, but as I state in the chasam sefer. Now, another thing the chasam sefer said, which I think is very true, the chasam sefer had a very, very great Rebbe. And we really only know about the Rebbe mainly from the Chasam Sefer himself. The Rebbe was a bit of a nister, but a phenomenally great, and the Chasam Sefer was machshavim, amazingly high. This is Rav Nassan Adler. Rav Nassan Adler was a gadol who lived in Frankfurt, where the Chasam Sefer grew up, and he kind of raised the Chasam Sefer. The Chasam Sefer, for whatever reason, kind of left his family home as a young boy, and Rav Nassan Adler raised him. Rav Nassan Adler, again, the Chasam Sefer speaks of him with phenomenal, phenomenal shvachas, but we have no writing from the Rav Nassan Adler. We have no svarim. So the Chasam Sefer said the following. He says, the reason why his Rebbe never wrote a Sefer is, the whole heter is that it shouldn't be forgotten. He says, his Rebbe never forgot anything. So his Rebbe had no heter to write down Torah Shebal Peh. But again, I mean, Lani has died the... Maybe the Chasam Sefer just said it as a humorous remark. But that can't be the svar. I mean, the Eis Lasuch Hashem is not because you're going to forget. It's that the Doros should be able to have Torah. So even if he's not going to forget, you write it down for other people. I mean, Rav Yehuda Nasi probably didn't forget any Mishnayos either, but you know, he wrote them down for the future generations. So that Chasam Sefer is very difficult to understand, unless he was just saying it as a humorous thing. Yeah.
The heter to make art scroll. If we already are not in danger of forgetting it, why make it in English and make it more accessible?
Well, that would be nichlal in Eis Lasuch Hashem. In other words, Eis Lasuch Hashem is that the Torah should not be forgotten from Am Yisrael. Now, it's true that even without art scroll, the Torah will not be forgotten. There'll be people who will learn and the like. But the Torah can be forgotten not only when it's totally forgotten. The Torah can be forgotten if you have more and more Jews who are not connected to it. So to create vehicles that allow more and more Jews to learn the Torah is preventing the Torah from not being lost. I mean, Torah is lost from any Jew that doesn't learn Torah has lost the Torah, right? So we could be marbit that way. Okay. But that's what the Gra says. That is the Maila of Taiv Ma'at B'yiras Shemaim. Okay. Let's skip down a little bit.
Why is the opposite of Yiras Hashem, the opposite of that is Mahuma?
Yeah, Mahuma. That's an interesting thing. The Gra is not aimed on that so much. The Gra seems to define Mahuma as Mirmais U'Gezelais, and Mirmos means deception. Gezela, of course, that's more in the economic aspect of the pasuk, or Peniais is biases, Vekavites, Vegaiva, right? Honor, pride, Mirmais, deception, you want to deceive people that you're a great Zalmid Chacham, Kintor is to cut people down, Kintor, you know, I want to learn so I can show, you know, somebody how ignorant they are, Videmeyim. That's called Mahuma. So now, Mahuma normally means confusion, right? That's interesting. We wouldn't automatically associate this with confusion or tumult. But he seems to say that the nature of Shalom Lishma is when you turn Torah into a contest. They'll tend to be, you know, shouting and yelling and the like. So it's interesting that he uses that for the word Mahuma. It's interesting. There was a Maisa. I mean, obviously we're not saying that if you learn Lishma, you know, you don't talk in learning and you don't debate in learning and you don't, you know, yell and scream in learning. That could be as well. But it's interesting that, the Rugachever, everyone heard of the Rugachever, right? The Rugachever is kind of, we can call the Rugachever our uncle, because if Rav Meir Simcha is our father, you know, or Sameach, Rugachever is our uncle, because right, this yeshiva is named after the Mechaber of the Sefer Or Sameach, who was Rav Meir Simcha Cohen. You can see the picture of the great, great person in the office. One should look at the picture. It's kedai to look at Rav Meir Simcha. And Rav Meir Simcha was the Rav in Dvinsk in Latvia. And he was Nifter in the 1920s. But the little city of Dvinsk was Zeicha to have two great Rabbanim, two Gedolei Olam at the same time. Very different, very good friends, and very different personalities. The Misnaged Rav of Dvinsk was Rav Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach, and the Chassidish Rav of Dvinsk was the Rugachev Ragov, because Rugachev was where he was born, Rav Yosef Rosen. So you have Rav Meir Simcha and Rav Yosef Rosen. Very, very different. Both of them were Ga'ina Yailam. This little city had two of the greatest Gedolim in a generation of Gedolim. But they were very, very different in personality. Rav Meir Simcha was quiet, edel, gentle, very, very soft-spoken. Rugachev was fiery, like a fire. Rugachev was actually a Chabad. Was actually a Chabad person. He was actually a Lubavitcher. Lubavitch says, I don't know, I don't know if it's 100% true, but Lubavitch says that the last Rebbe had smicha from the Rugachev, which would be a great monumental accomplishment. And the Rugachev was fire. You'd go to the Rugachev and you'd ask him any question. You would get immediately 100 Mara Makomos, Yushalmi, and Bavli, and Zohar, and Medrash, and Tosos. And the problem is, the Mara Makomos, you know, he thought so fast and he was such a genius that you couldn't even see the connection. To this day, there are full-time kollelim in which the job of these people are to take the Mara Makomos of Rugachev and try to figure out. The Rugachev will say, the answer to this Rambam is based on this Yerushalmi, he'll give you, and this Tosefta. And like it has nothing to do with anything. And they're tracing out the reasoning. Okay, the Rugachev must have said, in other words, instead of explaining it A, B, C, D, he goes from A to triple Z, and you have to try to figure out all the intermediate steps. There are people full-time. This is what they're trying to do. So the Rugachev was like fire. Sometimes even if somebody sent him a shaila, he might spend 5 lines or 10 lines explaining the significance of the date on the letter. Oh, this date, according to the Zohar, means this, different. So because of this, people were afraid of the Rugachev. He just, so Rav Aaron Cutler very much wanted. Rav Aaron Cutler was already a Rosh Hashiva at the age of 21, great Rosh Hashiva, and he wanted to speak and learning with the Rugachev. But he was afraid to come as a Rosh Hashiva because the Rugachev would destroy him, he thought. So he came as a working person. He said, I'm a person, I work half a day, I learn part of a day. And the Rugachev was very kind to people who were not Rosh Hashivas or whatever. He understood. So they spoke and learning for a while. And the Rugachev said, you know, for a Bala Bias, you learn okay. He said, that was the highest compliment. For a working person, you're okay. And then there was another Rav who came to him. And the Rav spoke, and the Rugachev was very nice to him. And the person said, wow, this was so pleasant. He says, I heard that the Rav is so tough on Talmidei Chachamim. So the Rugachev said, yes, I am very tough on Talmidei Chachamim. He said, okay, you know, whatever. So the Rugachev was very, very sharp. But the reason I'm bringing this Maisa in is that when he was very young, and he was already known as a foursome dicker genius, really one of the unusual genius, in fact. What Elohim used to do in those days, maybe they do it today, although I don't know if we have Elohim of that caliber, he would go to different Gedolim to kind of just debate with them, kind of test them out. You know, he could shlug up, they say a svara, he could, you know, shlug it up, just kind of debate, show how smart he was. So he was going to different Gedolim and, you know, this and that, debating with them. So he finds himself in Lublin, and he asks the Rebbe of Lublin, he's like a 16-year-old kid, he says, who's the big Talmud Chacham in this town? So he says, well, Rav Tzadok was the Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Tzadok was the big Talmud Chacham in Lublin. So he goes to Rav Tzadok. Rav Tzadok at that time was already like 60 or 70, and the Rugachev knocks at the door. And Rav Tzadok, you know, he sees it and he says, I want to talk in learning. So Sir Tzedek says, I mean, do you have a kasha? Is there something I could explain to you? No, I want to be mafalpo with you. I just want to talk and learning with you. I don't have any questions to ask you. I want to just talk and learning. So the Emes says, Rav Tzedek, as a young man, was very much like the Rugged Shepherd. So Rav Tzedek told the Rugged Shepherd, he says, you know, I used to be like you too, he says. 40 years ago, I was, you know, this big, you know, Eloi, and I went around, and he did, I went around, you know, arguing and slugging and yelling and proving and disproving and being mafalpa. But then he says, I realized that what does the Ribbono Shel Olam get out of all of this? You know, it makes me feel good, it gives me a reputation. He said to the Rugged Shepherd, he says, you go back, you know, continue to learn, continue to grow, continue to study, and give the Ribbono Shel Olam nachas in what you're doing. You don't have to go around showing people that you're better than them or smarter than them. He says, I used to do that too. But the Ribbono Shel Olam got no nachas from it. So the Rugged Shepherd said, his whole life, the Rugged Shepherd said that he was makabel that mussar. Although I can't say the Rugged Shepherd totally changed his teva, but the Rugged Shepherd was makabel that. And he said, you know, the point is not simply, you know, show how great you are or whatever it is. That's a getter of makantar, actually. It's considered to be a negative thing. So this is the idea. So maybe that's why it's called mahuma. And I'm trying to just address it. There's a long answer. Because this type of, I don't want to say show off, I don't want to put it as a basement, but the idea of just, you know, you want to go. Now, there's another aspect too, that there's Navardik, they used to say, you know, Navardik was a sheet of Musar. And Navardik said it was very, very important that a person have the Mida of Maida al Ha'emes. I mean, Chazal say this, Maida's meaning, when you're wrong, in learning in specific, it's true in all of life, but in learning in particular, to be Maida al Ha'emes. In fact, I'll tell you an Avardic story in a moment, but going from story to story here, by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was an Avreich in Yerushalayim, one of the greatest Avreichim as a young man, and he applied. Remember, people had to apply to be Rosh Yeshiva, so unless you start your own yeshiva, you got to apply like any other job, right? So he was very, very poor, he needed a parnasa, so he wanted to be a Magid Shir. So he applied to be a Magid Shir in Yeshivas Kol Torah, which is in Bayit Pagan, which he later became Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah. The Rosh Yeshivas then were Baruch Kunstadt, they were older Rosh Yeshivas. Really, he was a German, he was a Yucky Yeshiva. By the way, you look at pictures from the 50s, you see the Talmidim of Kol Torah, some of them were wearing shorts, very, very different. It's a different type of avir. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman gave a shir. So how do you apply for him to be a Magid Shir? You have to give a shir, right? You have to give a shir. It's very scary. Although Baruch Shem, Rosh Meirich didn't put me through that, but okay. But you have to give a shir. So he's giving a shir in front of the Rosh Yeshiva. And one of the Rosh Yeshiva asked him a kasha. And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, no, you slugged up my shir. You slugged it up. And he just said, I guess I really shouldn't go on. And he went home, and he told his Rebbetzin, he says, you know, I messed up, I gave a shir, and they asked a kasha that I didn't think of, and I guess I blew it. And later that afternoon, they bedafka asked him to be Rosh Yeshiva. And he said to Rav Kunstadt, he says, how could it be? I messed up. He says, no. He says, that's exactly the quality of an Adam Gadol. That when you saw that the other Svara was Emes, you were willing to be embarrassed, you were willing to admit, that is the greatest quality that we want our Talmidim to have. Because they said to him, and this is Emes, they said, listen, you could have answered, you could have twisted out, you could have finagled, you could have said, in other words, sometimes somebody asks you a kasha. I think we've all experienced this. And you may know in your heart that they're right. But you could give an answer, you know. If you know more than them, you know, you can give them an answer, even though you know they're right. Certainly, a great Talmud Chacham can usually give some type of answer to any question, even if. But being Maida La'emes is the Mida. That's when you know the other side is right. You're Maida La'emes. Right? So in a way, that's the opposite of mahuma, because mahuma means I'm always going to try to push my way. So in the Vardic, which is a Musar school, the story goes, they had two chavrusas who were learning, and they were arguing over pshat and taisus, and finally, the person said to the other one, "You're right, I'm maida, you have pshat." So the person said to him, "Don't say I'm right. Say the words you're wrong. Say I'm wrong." So the guy said, "What do you want from me? You're right. Just leave me alone." "No, no, no. You have to say you're wrong, because you have to be willing to say you're wrong." And that was a very big deal, because somehow it's easier to say you're right than to say I'm wrong. That we don't like to say. Right? But my dilemmas includes I have to be willing to say I did not have, you know, I was not right. Okay, so all of that is nichlal in learning with Yiras Shamayim, because you're not learning for the kavod, and you're not learning to put somebody down, chas v'shalom, and you're not learning even for a position, right? Although they say what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, an interesting thing he said, that what part of Shemona Esrei should you have kavana that Hashem should give you Torah knowledge? So he said, if you're learning in yeshiva, or a regular person, atachonei, that's when you ask Hashem for wisdom. He says, if, however, you're teaching in a yeshiva, you have to ask for it in v'sein bracha, when you ask for parnasa. Give me the tools to make a living. Okay. But the truth is, atachonei, you also need to ask it there. Ask it there as well. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's go down a little bit. Again, let me just remind you. Again, I hate the skipping, but again, I just wouldn't. It's not really possible to do every single pasuk. If you remember, we also looked at verse 24, pasuk Chavdalin. Just to remind you, this was a very famous teaching of the Gra, that in Avodas Hashem, it is not shayach to stay still. You're either in the constant process of growing, or you automatically will lose the levels that you have. And that is the diuk. The path of life is to go up in order that you should avoid falling down. And the Gra says that's exactly what the pasuk means. That if you're, life is like an escalator going down. If you stand still on an escalator going down, it's going to pull you down. You need to exert your energy to go up just to stay in place. So because of this, there's an interesting point here. To go back to the Mishkan a little bit. The Kli Yoker says, very beautiful thought. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about the Mishkan, Parshas Truma, all of those things. So if you remember, the very first thing that the Jewish people constructed for the Mishkan was they constructed the Aron HaKodesh, or Bezalel. That's the first thing they were commanded to construct. So the Aron HaKodesh has dimensions. 2.5 amos in length, amma v'chetzi, an amma and a half in width, and also an amma v'chetzi, amma and a half height. So the Kli Yoker points out, all of the dimensions of the Aron HaKodesh are fractions, meaning they're not whole numbers. 2.5 by 1.5, 1.5. These are called in Hebrew shavurot, broken. Now, we then look at the Shulchan. The Shulchan was the golden table where they put the showbread. Now, the showbread, the dimensions of the golden table, some of the midos, some of the dimensions are whole numbers, and some are fractions. Okay, if you look in the Chumash. So how come all of the midos of the Aron are fractions, and with the Shulchan, some are whole, and some are fractionated? So the Kli Yoker says, the Aron represents Torah knowledge, and learning of Torah, because what's in the Aron? The Luchos, the tablets, both the broken fragments of the first Luchos, and the second Luchos, according to one opinion in the Gemara, a Sefer Torah was in the Aron HaKodesh as well. Another opinion had the Sefer Torah outside of the Aron HaKodesh. So the Kli Yoker says, when it comes to Torah knowledge, I should always feel incomplete. I should never simply say, I know enough Torah, I'm fine. So that's why it's a fraction, meaning you never really are complete. You're never filled. That's Shavuos. Now, what does the Shulchan represent? The Shulchan represents Parnassa, bread. Right? That's why the Gemara says, in fact, that when you want to pray for wisdom, you turn to the south, because that's where the menorah was located. The menorah is also a symbol of Torah, the light of Torah. When you want to pray for wealth, you turn to the north, because that is where the shulchan is located, the bread, and that's the bracha for parnasa. Even though, what do you mean? You always pray towards the Beis HaMikdash, towards Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim towards the Mikdash. So that's our main direction, but then you can angle it a little bit to be slightly north or slightly south, whatever it would be, depending on whether you need wealth or whether you need Torah. So the Kli Yoker says, when it comes to Parnassa, we have two different attitudes. On one hand, some dimensions are full because I should always be Samech B'chalko. I should feel I have enough. I have enough. Shavuos, however, is a musr to you. Don't indulge in your taivas to the fullest extent. Meaning, in other words, you have enough, and you don't indulge with everything that you have. That's why it's shleimos and shavuos. And he goes on and says that this is a beautiful interpretation of a Gemara in Brachos, where the Gemara in Brachos says, Hamispalel, when you daven, your lave should be lamala, your heart should be towards God, v'yenav lamata, and your eyes should look downward. And indeed, that is the stance of a person that's davening. Normally our eyes are downward, although for kavana we can sometimes lift up our eyes, but the general stance is a na'im lamata. But the Kli Yoker offers this drush. He says, lev is the heart through which you want to understand Torah. When you want to understand Torah, you're always looking at the people that are better than you to say, I want to be like them, I want to grow. The einayim, it refers to material wealth. I see the wealth around me. I should look at the people who are worse off than me and be happy. In other words, so when it comes to gashmias, I look at the people who are worse off and I say, Baruch Hashem, I'm so good. When it comes to Ruchnias, I look at the people that I can grow from. Okay. Now, putting all of this together, therefore, when Pirkei Avos says, who is a wealthy person? He who rejoices in his lot. Sameach b'chelka. Does that apply to Ruchnias or does that apply to Gashmias? So the simple meaning is it applies to Gashmias. When it comes to material wealth, I should be happy with whatever Hashem gives me. I shouldn't look for more. In fact, that's what the Pasuk said, right? Tov leiv mishta tamid, you're happy with what you have. But in Ruchnias, Sameach b'chalkai, I should always strive to be more, right? That's what the Pasuk says, you gotta go up. So on one level that's true, but on the other level, on a deeper level, that's not true. On a deeper level, you have to be Sameach b'chelkai, not only in materialism, but you have to be Sameach b'chelkai even spirituality. Not in the sense that you don't challenge yourself, and not in the sense that you don't strive to be better, but in the sense that you recognize the uniqueness of the gifts that Hashem has given you. Meaning, you can look at other people and be jealous, oh, I don't have their memory, I don't have their whatever it would be. And that's not good. You have to have a simcha in what Hashem has given you, but then you don't rest on your laurels. You then challenge yourself to work within your parameters. So there is a sameach b'chelkai in recognizing the uniqueness of your mission and your ability, but then you can't be sameach b'chelkai in the sense of not trying to maximize it and not trying to challenge yourself better. In fact, they say mipi hashmua, this is not in Mishlei, although it's a beautiful pshat. It's explaining a pasuk in Mishlei, but it's an oral tradition. They say the name of the Gra, that's other Svarim Brim, although it's not in the Sefer itself. That's the idea that simultaneously with challenging yourself, you have to be happy and joyous in the accomplishments that you've done, because that will give you the energy to challenge yourself. If a person thinks he's a garnish, it's not going to make him want to be better. For carrots, when we think we're a nothing, then we don't have the energy to be better. Right? So the Pasuk says in Mishlei, it's a Gevaldik Pshat, Lev Chacham Liyaminai. The heart of a wise man is to the right. The Lev Kasil Lismola. And the heart of a foolish person is to the left. That's a Pasuk in Mishlei. So a Chayra, I don't want to say about anyone else, I don't know where your heart is, I can't say. But my heart is to the left. It could be I'm a fool. Yeah, that's not a kasha necessarily. But as far as I know, even very, very wise people, their heart is also to the left. Right? So what does it mean? The heart of a wise man is to the right, and the heart of a foolish person is to the left? What's the pshat? So they say mi pi hashmua, meaning it's an oral tradition, that lev refers to how you understand things. Now if you open up a sefer, Hebrew Sefer, to the right are the pages I've already learned, assuming I started from the beginning. To the left are the pages I haven't learned yet. A wise person looks at what he's learned and gets great joy. Baruch Hashem, I learned a Rashi, I learned a Mishnah, I learned a Halacha. And by looking at what he's learned and what he knows, he gets encouragement and chizuk to do more. The foolish person is looking at everything he hasn't learned. He's looking to the left. And he's saying, what's the use? I walk into a basement, I walk into this room, right? I look, how many of these svarim? And I say to myself too, how many of these svarim have I learned? Right, Baruch Hashem, I see 20 are the same, so if I could do one of them, I would have done it. But how many of these? What's the use? So what am I going to learn? I'm going to learn an Amud today? I'm going to learn a Taisus today? Great. That and another, 10 million Tosus, and I'll finish us. So that's what the Gra says. That's a big Yetzirah. The Chacham gets a joy in every little thing he accomplishes, and that pushes him to do more. The fool looks to the left, what he hasn't done, and says, what's the use of even starting? Right? So that encapsulates very nicely that even in Ruchnius, you have to have a simcha in what you accomplish, but you don't use it as an excuse not to go on and on. Right? So that's a simultaneous simcha, but also challenging yourself at the same time. Yeah.
When a person looks at the right and he sees everything he accomplished,
yep,
that could also be guidance.
Well, a person needs... Okay, well, here's the thing. A person needs pride in what he's done. That's absolutely the case. A person needs pride. Now, pride and gaiva, again, this is an example of the Hebrew and the English not quite matching up. A gaiva is when you become arrogant. Gaiva is when you look down at other people. Gaiva is when you behave in a superior way. And gaiva is when you don't recognize that these are gifts from Hashem, and you have to use your kochos for Hashem. But pride in what you're doing is very, very necessary. A person has to... In fact, there's a pasuk in Vayikba by King Yehoshaphat, who was a righteous king. Vayikba libo! His heart was proud in avodas Hashem, bedarchei Hashem. So you're right, it is an interesting dichotomy. But if a person truly feels he's worthless, he's nothing, B'zerah Klal, he's not going to be in Eved Hashem, because he's simply going to say, what's the use? In the Mesilas Yesharim writes, that's called a Frum Yetzer Hara. That's a Yetzer Hara, where through his humility he says he's worthless, and therefore he doesn't, why do I have to learn? It's not, I'm such a nothing. How is it going to count? So you need pride. In fact, this is why if you ever look at the pictures of yeshiva guys in Europe, Slobodka especially, you see they were kind of dressed very elegantly. I mean, they were all poor, but in fact, even you have to understand, the whole yeshiva dress, by the way, was the absolute opposite of what it really started off as. Today, it's kind of to separate yourself from secular society. The truth of the matter is the Litvish dress was to make you look like a well-dressed gentleman in secular society. Meaning, before President Kennedy, wearing a hat was a normal way. You know, look. In fact, President Kennedy destroyed the hat industry in the United States. It's only yeshiva guys and blacks, for some reason, who wear hats. But before President Kennedy, a regular geisha businessman would wear a hat. That's how you dress. And certainly in Europe, that was the way. So all of this thing about the hat and the jacket and all of this is because that was the dignified way that people dressed. And there was a cheshbon that many people in Europe, including religious Jews, they didn't have respect for B'nai Torah. They looked at them as bench warmers. They looked at them as people who weren't working. They looked at them. Some things don't change, right? These accusations still go out as people who are not productive, people who waste time, people who don't do anything for the world. And that affected the way the guys looked at themselves. They couldn't find shiduchim. So a decision was made that we have to build up a person's pride and build up a person's dignity to be well-dressed, dignified, gentleman. A little different than, you know. And with Dafke's sense of, now it's sometimes turned into arrogance, you're 100% correct. There's a little bit of a dangerous point that can sometimes turn into an arrogant where you look down at people who aren't learning or whatever it is. That's a sakana. That is a sakana. One has to be very, very careful. But it is still the case that a person needs a sense of pride. So we can actually say that pride is the most destructive thing that can exist. And it's the most necessary thing that you need at the same time. It is something that, if you take too much of it, it kills you. But if you have none of it, it also destroys you, right? So you need Rav Yeruchim of Mir. The Rav Yeruchim of Mir used to say that the person who does not know his chesreinus is a very, is a fool, because everyone has things that they have to improve on. But the person who doesn't know his greatness is a tragic person, because he doesn't even know that he has the capacity to become a greater person. Right? So that's an important thing to recognize. And that's what the Gra is saying. You have to take pride in what you're doing. You know, people quote this Gemara. I mentioned this before, but people quote the Gemara. The Gemara says, remember by the Levium? The Levium didn't begin their service in the Mishkan till the age of 30. But they began apprenticing. They began being assisting from 25. So 20, that's why one pasuk says 30, one says 25. So Rashi explains that they began apprenticing at 25. So why 5 years? So Rashi brings a Gemara in Chulin. From here we see that if you try to do something for 5 years and you're not successful, it's time to change. Because 5 years is enough time to see if you're good at something. And that's why they apprenticed for 5 years. If they weren't qualified after 5 years, they were given a different job or whatever. So people use that in yeshiva. I've been in yeshiva 5 years. No, didn't really accomplish that much. Maybe it's time to leave. So typically, when Bachram used this type of taina, the Rosh Yeshivas don't accept it. But they give two terms. There are two mahalchim. One is a bit deflating, and one is more uplifting. The deflating answer is, which could be true, he says, well, it says, you've been here and you've been learning for 5 years. Have you been learning? We don't think you've been learning for 5 years. So you haven't fulfilled the condition of the test, of the experiment. That's kind of the Musar answer. The other answer is, though, that the Stifel used to tell Bachram, he says, what do you mean? You've been learning for 5 years and you're not successful. What do you mean you're not successful? When you came here, could you learn a Mishnah? And the boy would say, no. Can you learn a Mishnah now? He says, yeah. That's success. You can read a Rashi. You couldn't read. That's success. Maybe you didn't succeed all that you could have done and that you thought you would do. But you can't say you didn't succeed. Right? You had some hatzlacha. And one has to treasure that hatzlacha. That hatzlacha is a great, great thing. You see, we are human. We cannot look at ourselves as angels. We need positive reinforcement in life. You know, and if you need positive reinforcement, you can't go around telling yourself, "Oh, I'm such a rusher. I need somebody to tell me I did a good job. Okay, it's okay, it's okay. You can have that, and you need that, and sometimes you have to give it to yourself. That's what the Gemara says. Say, okay, Baruch Hashem, I can read. Even reading Hebrew is a great victory. In fact, I've heard from Rav Pinchas, other people, I think from my own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Weinberg, who I don't remember apropos of what, he said he actually felt that when a boy comes to yeshiva, let's say Balchua doesn't know how to read Hebrew yet, he says, the first year, we should only concentrate on reading. Because if a person knows how to read well, that's a tremendous door opener for everything. Tremendous door opener, right? Okay, so maybe it would bore a person just to work on reading, we got to do other things too, but okay. But those are great, great accomplishments. Couldn't read, now you can read? Wow. You know? So I'm not against pride. I think a person needs to have pride. A person needs positive reinforcement. A person needs chizuk. A person needs to understand that they've achieved things, but not in the complacent sense. Oh, Baruch Hashem, I've achieved, so I'll take the rest of the week off. But yeah, Baruch Hashem, I achieved, and I can achieve more. And that's what the Gemara is saying. The Chacham looks at the right and says, ah, Baruch Hashem. The Ksil says, oh, so much to do. What's going to be the use? Of course, the Gros Mashal works only if you start from the beginning, right? Sometimes we if you open a sefer to the middle, all right, even if I look to the right, so much I didn't do. But okay. The Gros is assuming that you start from the beginning. So that's something to remember.
But when the Mishnah was written, they didn't have sworn. They didn't have this binding.
Yeah, but it still works. It still works. I mean, think of a scroll.
When you're up and down.
No, but it's the same thing. In the way Hebrew works, when you roll the scroll, right? If I roll the scroll, roll a Megillah. So the part to the right is the part I've already read. It works equally with the scroll. Right? The left is what I'm coming to. I didn't do yet. Right? So that's the same thing. Okay. Alrighty. Okay, let's skip down to Pasuk Lamed. Again, a very beautiful pasuk. Ma'or einayim yismach leiv, yisamach leiv. The light of the eyes brings joy to the heart. Again, simple meaning. Try to always understand the mental picture, because Mishalim are trying to teach things by images and pictures. That is, light makes people happy. Right? When you're dark, you feel gloomy. And when there's bright light, you see colors. And that gives a person simcha, the light of the eyes. In fact, there's even a whole thing. And some people get depressed during the winters because seasonal affective disorder. That's why they have special light boxes, which gives them, light. People really get seriously depressed in the winter and the like. So it says light brings a person joy. And by the same token, therefore, good news, Shemua Tova, a good news that you hear, to Dashain Etzen, it makes your bones stronger, you feel more vibrant. If you remember, just to remind you, it's interesting that this is yet the second mention of the story in Gittin. We talked before about Rav Tzadok, who fasted in that same Gemara. If you recall, very, very interesting, the political situation at the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni was very, very fascinating and ultimately very tragic. That is, there were many, many Jews who were determined to rebel against Rome and to fight the Roman Empire. But the Chachamim were against it. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was absolutely against it. He says, we do not deserve that Hashem will do it. It would take a miracle to defeat Rome. But Derech HaTeva, we would have no way of defeating them. Elamai, Hashem is going to protect us. We're not on the Madrega. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's Shita was surrender to Rome. And his Shita was, if we surrender to Rome, they would allow us to keep the Beis HaMikdash. And that's 100% correct. The Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash not because they hated the Beis HaMikdash. The Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash primarily to crush the rebellion of these Jewish people. And had they listened to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Beis HaMikdash would not have been destroyed. Now obviously, it was Hashem's Gezerah. I mean, all of these things happened. But Lamaisa, the political reason for the cause, for the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, the spiritual reason was Sinas Chinam. The political reason was the fact that the Zealots refused to surrender to Rome. So if you remember, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai wanted to be smuggled out of the city to have a private negotiation with Vespasian, who at that time was the general. He actually became emperor during the story. And how do you smuggle him out? Because the Zealots would not let any Jew leave the city. Because the Zealots did not want anyone to make a peace treaty with the Romans. So the only way you could be smuggled out is if you were... The Zealots were Jews who were rebelling against Rome. They were a war party. They were a violent war party. And they would kill any Jew who wanted to make peace with the Romans. Okay? So the leader of the Zealots, this is all in the Gemara, we'll read this on Tuesday. The leader of the Zealots was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's own nephew. Wow. So he goes to the guy and says, I want to talk to Vespasian. The leader says, sorry. I mean, I'd let you go, but my men are going to kill you if you go. So he gave Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai an idea. Play dead. Make believe you're dead. And the Romans and the Zealots allowed dead bodies to be taken out of the city to be buried. And, you know, your Talmidim will take your body out, and then you'll be able to get out of the coffin. So he's dead. So he plays dead. He's in a coffin. He's carried by his students to the gates of Jerusalem. So the Zealots, these are Jews, the Zealot guards say, you don't take it out, throw the coffin over the wall and let it just hit the ground. So they said, you can't do that. The Romans are going to say that the Jews take their own rabbis and just throw them over the wall. That's so disrespectful. They said, okay, we'll let you go, but I'm going to pierce our sword through the coffin to be sure that this body is dead. Why didn't they just open the coffin? I'm not sure, but they said, and they said, no! They're going to say, the Romans are going to say, you pierce your rabbis. All right, so they let Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai go. They opened the coffin and from a distance, and he was able to go to Vespasian. And he says to Vespasian, Shalom Alecha Malka, I greet you, King, I greet you, King. By the way, in the Medrash, it actually gives us Latin, Vivo Empora, the Medrash says. Because Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai didn't speak Hebrew to Vespasian. The Roman language was Latin. Viva Impera, right? Mamish, Viva Impera. Long live the emperor. And what did Aspasianus say? That's Vespasian. He said, you are Chayav Misa for saying that. Because for two reasons. Either way, first, I'm not an emperor, and you're calling me emperor. You deserve to die. And second, if I am an emperor, what took you so long to get here? And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's answer was, you're not emperor yet, but you're going to be emperor. And I couldn't get out. And immediately at that moment, a shaliach came from the Roman Senate and said, you have been appointed emperor. You have to go back. That's why Vespasian was replaced by Titus, his son. Vespasian became emperor and Titus became the general who actually destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. And Titus then became emperor himself and erected the famous triumphal arch in Rome that commemorates the destruction of the temple. And the minhag of Jews is we don't walk under that arch, because that's the, on top of that arch is the Jews being led in chains and the menorah and everything else, etc. Okay. Yeah, this is the arch of Titus. But be it as it may, Vespasian was in the middle. When the shaliach came, Vespasian was taking off his shoes. So he had taken off one shoe, and then he gets the great news. And he can't take off the other shoe. It's too tight. So he tries to put on the other shoe that he took off, and also, it's too small. So he says to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, what's going on? So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai quotes this pasuk, Shemula Tova to Dashay Netzem. Good news makes your bones grow thicker. So you hear good news, so your body expands, so to speak. So he says, so what do I do? I can't take my shoes off. He says, have some other guy you don't like walk by you, and that'll shrink. And something where it says acts like that. One of his enemies walked by, you shrank, right? So good news makes you feel bigger, actually become bigger, right? Right, so the Gemara uses it quite literally. This was mamish the Shakla Bataria between Aspasianos and Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. By the way, it's very, very interesting. If you remember, again, this is what I said before, that Aspasianos asked before, he said, before I go back to Rome, ask me for whatever you want and I'll give it to you. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for three things. He said, spare the little town of Yavne where the Chachamim could gather afterwards and keep Torah alive. Number two, spare Rabban Gamliel, who was the Nasi, and his family. And number three, medical treatment for the great Rav Tzaddik. And Vespasian granted them. Now the Gemara says, it must be that Hashem took away wisdom from the wise at that pivotal moment. Because if he could have asked for whatever he wanted, why didn't he ask for the Beis HaMikdash to be spared? And the Gemara actually said that at the critical moment, Hashem took away the wisdom of the Chacham. But the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's own cheshbon was the famous statement, Tafasta Meruba. If you try to grab too much, you wind up losing everything. And he thought, if I would ask for that, I would get nothing at all. I would ask for less. But there are various sources that there were some people among the Hamonam who had tainus on Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They actually considered him to be at fault for not, he got so close to the emperor, that for not asking for the Beis HaMikdash to be. But again, this was his cheshbon, and this was his cheshbon. Yeah. So that's one pshat, that good news makes your bones grow bigger and stronger. But the Gra offers the following idea. The Gra says an interesting thing. The Gra says, first of all, before I get to the Gra, Ma'or Einayim, there are actually two famous svarim that are named Ma'or Einayim, the light of the eyes. You may have heard of it. One sefer is a Hasidish sefer, and one is a very controversial sefer. The Hasidish sefer, the first Chernobyl Rebbe, is Ma'or Einayim, around 150, maybe 180 years ago. Very, very chush of a sefer, a beautiful sefer, Ma'or Einayim. But there's an earlier Ma'or Einayim that was written in the time of the Maharal, which is a very path-breaking sefer, but the Maharal lambasted it tremendously. This was from an Italian Talmud Chacham, Azaria de Min Adumim, which is Azaria de Rasi. And Ma'or Einayim was one of the first Sifrei Kodesh, or one of the first Svarim, that compared, let's say, the historical Agadita with Josephus and Philo. These were Jewish sources that had not been used by Jews before. And, he compared them and he contrasted them, and he sometimes said in matters of science, he casts, says Chazal, were not always accurate in matters of science and history, although in matters of Amunah and Hashkaf and Halacha, we have to be Mekabel Chazal, but in matters of history and the like, we can look at other sources to correct Chazal. So this was his sefer, Ma'or Einayim. In the secular academic world, Ma'or Einayim is considered to be wonderful, because it tried to create, scholarly independence. But the Maharal devotes in the Ber HaGola. The Ber HaGola is the Maharal's famous sefer defending Chazal. So he writes how the Ma'or Einayim, he says, somebody told me I have to read this sefer, somebody told me this was a great sefer, and I read it, and the Maharal talks about it, he goes on pages and pages. He says, I ripped my garments, I put ashes on my head. He says, what a chorban that a person was mevazeh Chazal this way. And the Maharal really, really, really was tzibrachim over this sefer. What's amazing is that even though the Maharal condemned the sefer so much, it continued to be used as a source of haras. I mean, the Maral Zong Talmidim. The Maral was in Prague. Now, the Taisus Yamtuf, the Kliyakar, these were the successors of the Maral in Prague. They were his Talmidim. They continued to quote the Maranayim. In other words, they basically said that, you know, it's like the pomegranate, the mushel that the Gemara says, Reb Meir and Acher. You throw away the rinds and you eat the seeds. So Maranayim is still used by different sources, but it was a very controversial work. But that's done. That was taken from here. But be as it may, this is what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Maranayim is a remez to Taira Shebichsav. Because Einayim is what you see. Right? So the part of Torah that I see is the written Torah. And that is called Or, Torah Or. So the light of my eyes, when I see the Torah and I am enlightened, that gives me the simcha in my heart. Shemua Tova is what you hear. Now what you hear is Torah, again, now it's all written down, but initially, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, the Shemua is Torah Shebal Peh. And the Gra says the following, the difference between Lev and Etzem is, Lev refers to a person's deep intuitive understanding, which cannot necessarily turn into how you're supposed to behave. It's just a connection to God, but it doesn't yet give me concrete guidance as to what to do. So when you read the Psukim of the Chumash, right, you're connected to Hashem. There is the simcha of your heart. But you can't translate it into actual behavior, because without Torah Shebal Peh, you don't know what your behavior is supposed to be. I read ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. But I can't, that's not the halacha. So the difference would be, the light of the Torah Shebichsav gives you a great joy in your heart, but you don't yet know how to translate that joy into action. Shemua Tova, but through the good Torah Shebal Peh, your bones get strengthened. Bones are how you do things, right? You can now do things. You can take the teachings of Torah Shebichsav and you can carry them out in Lamaisa. Right? So that's the idea, that Torah Shebichsav can give you the simcha, the Torah Shebal Peh also gives you the simcha, but it adds the ability to carry the directives of Hashem out into the world of Maisa itself, and that is Tidashen Etzem. He also makes the point, Tidashen Etzem means you can strengthen bones, meaning not just your bones, strengthen the bones of others. Meaning to say that when I teach Torah Shebal Peh, by definition, I am interacting with somebody else, right? So as a result, it is not just me who gets stronger. It's that person who gets stronger as well. Tidashen, it's a shemua tova. So according to the Gra, shemua tova does not mean good news, but it means a good teaching of the Torah Shebal Peh. Tidashen etzem. Okay. Next pasuk. Lamed aleph. Aizen shaymas teichachas chayim. An ear that hears tochecha, the rebuke, mutzer, that gives life, bekerev chachamim talin, shall dwell among the wise. So, again, it's not entirely clear. One meaning simply is that if I'm willing to hear mutzer, that means I'm willing to take criticism, I'm willing to work on myself, I'm willing to understand that I'm not perfect. That will give me the koach to be among the chachamim, meaning to say, that's how one becomes wise. One becomes wise by being willing to take constructive criticism. The Gra says a little different. The Gra says that this pasuk, and this is quite interesting, this pasuk is addressed to people who may hang around the Beis HaMedrash and not really be able to understand that much. I remember when I used to live in Chicago many, many years ago, there was a fellow, a chashuv person, he's not alive anymore, an older man, who used to go to every shir, like in the city, you know, every shir, all the time, morning to night. He was retired already. And he immediately proceeded to fall asleep at every shir he went to. Every shir, yeah, yeah. And I don't mean like, you know, towards the end of the shir. I mean, mitzchila v'yatso. Come in, you know, come in, fall asleep. Then he would get up to go to the next shir. You know, fall asleep. You know. So like, what's the purpose? So, well, actually, this may not totally answer it, but we're talking about, is there a purpose in going to shiurim? Is there a purpose in hanging around people who are learning if you're not really growing in that way? So the Gra says there is a purpose. Well, and he gives this pasuk is giving us two purposes. Purpose number one is, even if you don't follow the actual thing that they're learning, but you will get a message as to what is important in life. In other words, you will be an ozen shomas tochachas chayim. You are hearing the messages of life. You are hearing that it's important to serve Hashem. You're hearing it's important to do mitzvahs. Maybe you didn't follow, you know, all of the different mamorim that were brought in and all of the different commentaries that were brought in. But you walk away with a message of what is important. And that can affect you when you walk into the street, when you go back to business, or whatever it is. So the Gra says there is something significant in the ozen that is hearing the tochacha. So it's not the chronic. It's not a tochacha directed to him. It's not he hears him. In other words, but the general idea of what is important in life, and that's a mila. And the second is by simply hanging around the wise, things rub off. And at a minimum, the Gra says, you're keeping yourself off the street, you're keeping yourself out of trouble. In other words, the time that I'm in the Beis Medrash listening to a shir, I'm not doing something else. I'm not doing Lashon Hara, I'm not doing Gezel, or whatever it is. So this is an important idea, that to simply hang around Chachamim is a certain positive benefit. Now, there is more to this, because yes, hanging around is a positive benefit, but you also have to make a cheshbon. Is it the best use of my time? In other words, if I can go to a place where I could learn more or understand more, I should do so. And also, you have to keep in mind the effect that it has on a person. And this is a problem in the yeshiva world we sometimes have, and that is, sometimes a person's in yeshiva, and they're not doing a lot. They're just hanging around. They're just hanging around. Now, is there a mila in just hanging around? Well, according to this pasuk, there is a mila in hanging around. You're hearing words of Torah, you're with Talmidei Chachamim. And all of that is true. There is a mila to hang around. But sometimes hanging around can have a very devastating psychological effect on a person. It makes a person feel worthless. It makes a person feel non-productive. It makes a person just feel aimless and depressed. When that happens, then it is not the right environment. I mean, the Gra is highlighting in this pasuk the potentiality of the positive benefit, and there is. 100% there's a positive benefit. But like everything else, you also have to cheshbon the negative detriment, and sometimes the negative is worse than the positive. So in many, many cases, well, I don't want to say many cases, but in a number of cases, a person is well advised to combine his Torah with working. And then he would have a greater sense of accomplishment. And then when he learns, he will find his learning to be augmented. But it goes back to what I said before. It is essential that a person has a sense of self-esteem, and that a person feels that they are producing and growing in their lives. And if that requires adjustments to the conventional yeshiva schedule, then for them that would be necessary, and it would not be a failure to the way that they serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, that could cause them to learn better. I remember reading that there was a businessman in Muncie, when Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was in Muncie, who Baruch Hashem would learn half a day and then work half a day, and because he was Matzliach, he wanted to have early retirement. Because he said he could learn all day. So he went to Rav Yaakov. And Rav Yaakov said like this, I can't give you a psak that you shouldn't learn all day. How can I tell you? But I think you should stick with what you're doing. Why is that? He says, because now, you know, you're disciplined, you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know that you work from 6 to 1, and then you have a Seder from 2 to 7, and you know, now if you have the whole day to learn, so what's going to happen? You're going to say, all right, no, why do I have to get up at 6 o'clock? I have the whole day to learn, I'll go to the 8:30 minyan. No, I come a little late to morning Seder. In other words, the whole idea of your time being so precious kind of sometimes can evaporate when you have all this time. Right? Sometimes it's kedai for a person to have limited time because then they treasure the time much more. So Rav Yaakov actually said, I think it's possible, this depends on knowing the person, but I think for a man like you, you will learn better if you learn half a day than if you had the whole day. If you had the whole day, you know, this and that. Again, it's a question of psychologically understanding how people respond to schedules and pressure and everything else. Of course, Baruch Hashem, I know with the Arar Sameach Kollel, that's no problem, because Aisha, if you're 15 minutes late, you know, this money goes off, and that money goes off, so Baruch Hashem, people are held to a very very tough schedule here. Okay.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about the... Yeah. Could be a basic point. Even if he would learn one more minute if he did the retirement schedule, isn't that still like...
Yeah, so... I think what Rav Yaakov is doing is that, you know, you're correct in the short term. But I think what happens in the long term, I think Rav Yaakov is looking at the midos that are nishtaresh in a person. And there are, he saw the potential of the midos of atzlus, and maybe the midos of yiyush, and the miyush, and these are like introducing cancers. Now, if God forbid a person gets cancer in the early stages, you know, his life could go on for a long time just as good, but eventually it's miskaber over a person. And in that sense, therefore, you know, you need, in fact, maybe, it might even be nichla, although it's bedavka, not what I said before, in Taiv Ma'at B'Yiras Hashem, meaning to say that the intensity and commitment of learning might in fact be more chashuv. And to lose that would be Yatsa Schare B'Hefseid in that sense. Okay. Alrighty. Last pasuk I just want to show you, is just you'll skip down to pasuk Lamed Gimel. And that is Yiras Hashem Musar Chachma. So here the Gra says a very interesting thing. The Gra says, the fear of God is the rebuke of wisdom. So the Gra says, and this is only true in Hebrew, and in English you don't have this ambiguity. Syntactically, you could translate this phrase in two ways. The fear of God brings a person to the Musar of wisdom, or the Musar of wisdom brings a person to the fear of God. Which is which? Meaning to say, is it Yiras Hashem brings a person, meaning is the Musar of Chachma, or is the Musar of Chachma Yiras Hashem? And what would that mean in either event? So the Gra says, the ambiguity here is intentional. There is a Yira that brings a person to Musar, and there is a Musar that brings a person to Yira. And he says, going back to our earlier discussion, there are two types of Yiras Hashem. There is Yiras Hashem, which is Yiras Ha'onesh, fear of punishment, I gotta behave. And then there's Yiras Hashem, that is awe and reverence. So he says the following, Yiras Ha'onesh is the initial motivator that brings a person to Musar. Musar meaning, I work on improving myself. Now, if I start with bad midos, I don't necessarily feel the awe and reverence of God. I'm not connected to God. So what's going to motivate me to even do this? Well, at a minimum, the idea of punishments. If you believe in Hashem, again, we're not talking about someone who doesn't believe in Hashem, that's a different parasha. We're talking about someone who does not feel a kesher to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So, what motivates me is, well, I really better do something about this, because there are, after all, punishments and sufferings. So the Yiras Hashem of Yiras HaOnesh brings a person to working on his midos, improving himself, striving. But then it works the other way as well. In the process of improving yourself, your heart is more and more open to Hashem. And then you feel Yiras HaRomamus, you feel the awe and reverence. And that'll push you more. So the Yiras HaOnesh brings you to Musar, and the Musar in turn brings you to Yiras HaRomamus. It goes in both directions. And then the final phrase is Lifnei Kavod Anava. Now this is to be read in conjunction with another pasuk. One second. Let me show you the other pasuk. The other pasuk is actually a very famous pasuk. Look in the next perek, 16 perek design, pasuk Yudches, verse 18. Lifnei Shever Gaon. Because these phrases, in fact, I don't know why it's not in the same pasuk. Lifnei Shever Gaon. This is a very famous pasuk, even in English. You've heard pride comes before the fall. You've heard this phrase. So this is from Mishle. Lifnei Shever, before you're broken, comes your pride. Meaning, pride is what's going to cause a person to be broken. And here he says the opposite. What will cause a person to be honored? Anava, humility. Right, humility. Hashem will give the person kavod. With gaiva, Hashem will give the person shever. Okay. Of course, it's an interesting question. Anava is the person who doesn't want kavod. So, is he getting what he doesn't want? But it says, but the truth is that the kavod that the humble person gets, he uses to serve Hashem. Right. So, the Chavetz Chaim didn't want kavod. Of course. But the Chavetz Chaim knew that through the kavod that people gave him, he would be able to influence them to Hashem. So he took kavod as also an opportunity to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is why a person's kavod is important, because kavod is one of the vehicles, each according to our madrega, by which we can be a force for good. Right? A person wants to be able, you want to be a potential good influence, at a minimum, to your own children, right? At a minimum, and then hopefully talmidim, friends, other people. You want to be a good influence. But in order to be a good influence, people have to respect you. Your kids have to respect you. But if your kids don't respect you, then what you're doing is no good. So kavod means in the sense that people look at you as an honorable person. They honor you, they respect you, is something that is needed in Avodas Hashem, because that is the vehicle of how we are influencing people in a good way. And again, even if we're not public in any way, our own families, whatever it is. If a wife doesn't respect a husband, then the husband is not going to be an influence in any good way, besides the fact that without kavod, we ourselves get broken, right? So even an anav needs kavod, because kavod is how he will be mashpia on other people. Okay, stop here. You have a good week. Thanks, everybody. I don't know if it's the end. Is this Manif? Is the Beis Medrash going on this week too, or just Machina? Do you have Kol this week?
We stopped on Friday.
Okay, so it's only, I know Machina is going on to the whole week. Okay, alrighty. So have a good week of learning, and it's a good Hachana for Pesach.